most of the headlines Brooke Astor has made over the past half century have been for her good works in support of New York institutions like the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Bronx Zoo, and the New York Public Library. But last year, the stories in the tabloids were less happy about a battle over her estate and her health care. In her latest biography, The Last Mrs. Astor, A New York Story, Frances Kiernan looks into Mrs. Astor's life up to the present. It is published by Norton. I'm very pleased it has brought Frances Kiernan back to my show today. Hello.
Oh, Lenny, I'm pleased to be back.
Mrs. Astor is a very different sort of person from Mary McCarthy, the subject of your first biography. Do they have anything in common?
Well, yes, they do. I mean, immediately you think, oh, Mary McCarthy had this sharp tongue. Mrs. Astor was always polite. She was a lady. But they did have a joy in life. I also think they were self-created. You can't look behind either woman and see a predecessor. And then a friend of Mary McCarthy said something that I think is true of Mrs. Astor as well. She said, being in her company was like living in a novel. Everything was fresher, more vivid. And I would say, having spent time with Mrs. Astor, actually in her late 90s, she had that ability, even then.
It's been said of Mrs. Astor that her story is out of Edith Wharton. Do you see that connection?
Well, it's funny. She was born into what she called the Edwardian age. She was born in 1902, and she was raised in an environment that went back further. But I think there is one connection. A friend said to me she was reminded of Lily Bart. Mrs. Astor was Lily Bart in the House of Mirth. Lily Bart is the little sister of the rich. And Mrs. Astor, for much of her life, was the little sister of the rich, somebody who was around because she was decorative, entertaining, had some money, but she was not extremely wealthy. Lily Bart, at a certain point, has to make some choices, and she has to marry well, or she's going to be in serious trouble. She chooses not to make a marriage of convenience, and she ends up dead. Mrs. Astor makes the marriage of convenience.
Is 105 years old.
Yes. And I would also say Mrs. Astor had a shrewd mother and father, and Lily Bart didn't have that. But she was a real survivor. She was incredibly charming, but she had a lot of common sense from the very beginning.
Where did she grow up?
She grew up all over the world. She was born in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, but really spent her very early childhood in Washington, D.C., where her parents had a home and where her grandparents and maternal grandparents lived. But her father was a career officer in the Marine Corps, a Navy graduate of Annapolis who was assigned to the Marines, and he was assigned to various diplomatic missions. So as a small child growing up, she lived in Panama, she lived in Hawaii, she lived in Newport, and she lived most importantly in China.
And was a witness to some pretty historic events
Yes, she wasn't there for the Boxer Rebellion, but she was there for the end of Imperial China.
The fall of the Qing Dynasty.
Yeah, and she felt she saw the death of the great empress. In fact, she saw the death of the second empress. But what was amazing was she also saw some very brutal scenes. On her way home from a friend's house one day, she saw a decapitated corpse hanging upside down. She also, at the same time, was living a very rarefied diplomatic life, going to costume parties with children from the French and English legations. And all of this together helped produce Brooke Astor. She also, because she was an only child and she had a very social, flirtatious mother and a very active, busy father, was thrown in the company of servants. Her father said to her when she arrived in China, if she would learn Chinese, make a serious effort, he would manage to get her a horse, a pony, and as many dogs as she wanted. And she did. And one of her great companions was number one boy, the Chinese houseman who ran their establishment, and he was a great friend of hers. So early on, she began to mix with people from all classes of society and to value them.
Was she raised to be charming and agreeable?
Well, she watched her mother, who was the belle of Peking, many people said. Her father was not a high-ranking diplomat, but they moved in the highest circles because of that mother. She was a bit of a wallflower and a disappointment to her mother as a child. She was a reader. She loved to play with her dolls, and she loved her dogs. The dolls vanished with time, but the dogs stayed with her always, and she always loved to read.
There are people who've said that her charm is manipulative and her agreeable nature is part of her way of climbing the social ladder.
I would say that charm was innate. It's something you can't fake. When I met her, I had been told she preferred men to women, and I think that probably was true. But she did like women. And what made her charming in part was she was curious about you. She wanted to know everything about you, and you don't fake that. And you rise to the occasion if you're with someone like that.
And how did you meet her? You were working at The New Yorker at the time.
No, I was actually finishing up my last book, The Life of Mary McCarthy, Seeing Mary Plain. And we had a mutual friend, John Hart, who was much younger than Mrs. Astor, but was often a date of hers. John looks older than he is. He has a brindled beard and hair, and in his 20s he did.
Well, it's going to be difficult for her to find a date her own age.
Well, that's true. Even, you know, some of her most serious male friends in the middle of her life and later were 8 years younger than she was. But most of them didn't realize that she was a very youthful whatever she was. She loved exercise. She swam throughout the year. She had an indoor pool up at her estate in Holly Hill. And she loved to walk. And she loved walking her dogs. She could walk anyone into the ground into her 90s. And she was fit. In fact, someone, her friend Freddie Malhotto, said of her, until you danced with Brooke Astor, you didn't realize how strong she was.
How accurate are her memoirs?
Well, that's an interesting... Well, how accurate are anyone's memoirs? It's an interesting question.
Some people are interested in kind of telling the truth, and others are not at all.
I think she was interested in telling the truth, but by the time even she sat down to write the first one in 62, she was already 60 years old. And she was looking back on her childhood, and she had some diaries to work with, and she had very few people from back then. And she'd been telling these stories forever. And anyone who's told a few stories in their day, even without intending to, you develop them. You make them better. I know when I was doing both books, I transcribed interviews sometimes 2 or 3 years after doing them. And I would be reporting to people about what I had heard. And then when I'd actually transcribe them, I realized I had actually made them better as I talked about them. It's a natural storytelling facility we all have, even those of us who don't think of ourselves as storytellers. And she was a great natural writer. So I think her memoirs can be trusted to a point, that she was deliberately obscuring facts or manipulating them. I wouldn't go so far as to say that's true.
Well, she first married at 17. And you described that marriage as an unhappy one, but it lasted 10 years. Why did it finally end? I'm assuming that if it was really bad, it lasted 10 years because divorce was so uncommon at the time.
Well, yes, it started in 1919 and ended in 1929. And what's interesting is her husband beat her. He abused her. He was an alcoholic. He was very wealthy. They were dependent on his parents, on his father in particular. They lived in Bernardsville, New Jersey. She had a very luxurious life, even though she had a not particularly happy life, and she learned to make the best of it. She had a child halfway through the marriage, and that was another reason to stay. And with time, she too found romantic interest. She learned to flirt. She learned to make, and that was her nature, to make the best of a bad bargain. And she had nowhere to go. Her parents had no serious money. She was a middle-class girl. She was not a rich girl. And her parents at that point were in Haiti. And what finally happened was he asked for the divorce. His father died. And suddenly he had the courage to do something he would never have done when his father was alive. He had found a woman he wanted to marry. And I think Brooke was a little taken aback. But it was the best thing that could have happened for both of them.
And their child is the child that we read about most recently.
Yes, Anthony Marshall was born Anthony Couser. And when he came of age, which was during World War II, and he joined the Marine Corps very much influenced by his grandfather, who he admired enormously. And he also very much admired Brooke's second husband, whose name was Charles Marshall. She married Charles Marshall 2 years after the divorce, and he became a real father to Tony Couser.
Known as Buddy Marshall. He was a stockbroker, and their marriage lasted 20 years, but he was not as wealthy as the first husband.
As the Cousers, but he had a sister who was very wealthy, who had been married to Marshall Field Jr., and who got the biggest divorce settlement in America at the time of $1 million. And Evie Fields. And he had money, and more than most of us have, but it wasn't the same kind of money. And they had a lovely apartment on Gracie Square. In fact, it's an apartment, I think, that now belongs to Jean Stein. I was recently in, and it's a penthouse overlooking the river. And we would all be very happy in that apartment.
But she was working at Condé Nast. Well, was it because she was bored or because they needed extra money?
Well, halfway into the marriage, after World War II, he had less money. And for various reasons, too complicated to go into. And she took this job as features editor. It wasn't a high-paying job, but it was extra money. It gave her money for clothing, for whatever she wanted. And she was very good at it. And she used her social connections to get into houses that they would never have gotten into to photograph them. And she would actually organize photo shoots, and she would do some writing. Already she was writing.
My guest is Frances Kiernan. Her latest biography is The Last Mrs. Astor, A New York Story. It is published by Norton. So then Buddy died in 1952, and that was a happy marriage, would you say?
It was a very happy marriage. They were married for 20 years, and it was a shocking death. They were up at their house in the Berkshires for Thanksgiving weekend, and after the guests had come for a Thanksgiving cocktail party, and then she and her mother, who was widowed by then, and Buddy had a light supper. He went out to let the dog out or whatever, and they heard a crash, and he had collapsed. He died in her arms.
How long before she met Vincent Astor?
Well, that is the crux of the story, in a way. She was devastated, and she was truly the bereaved widow. And there was a big funeral at St. James. Buddy was loved by all of New York. He was president of the Brook Club. He was a very clubbable man, but women loved him. Everyone loved Buddy Marshall. He was your idea of the perfect gentleman. And in the book, there's a picture of him as a young man. He was a very handsome man. No one ever had a bad word to say about Buddy Marshall.
And unlike Vincent Astor.
Exactly. And so Brooke was really not doing well, and then she goes off to Europe. Her aunt takes her in hand and says, "You're not doing Buddy's memory any justice by looking like a sad crow. You know, pull yourself together, girl." And she comes back to New York, and she's not been working for a while, and she's invited to a dinner party, and she wears black, but it's a black sort of off-the-shoulder, Dior-looking gown, and she had really a lovely body figure, whatever. And she arrives, and it's a small party, and Vincent Astor is there with his current wife, his second wife, Minnie Cushing.
Who wants to dump him. She acts as a kind of a matchmaker, doesn't she?
Well, in a way, she does. Minnie Cushing was Babe Paley's sister, and she and Vincent had been married quite a while and had had an affair before then. And he was not an easy man, and she was ready to leave, and I think she had someone in mind. But she felt, and perhaps rightly, that she would get a better settlement in the divorce if she left him happy. He was a man who liked to be married. He had married young to Helen Hull, and he had been married all of his life. And so there were at least three candidates for Vincent's hand, which Brooke doesn't talk about, and she may not have been aware of it, in fact. But at this dinner, Vincent comes over to her after dinner, and he says he's very, very sorry that he hasn't written her because, you know, he should have written her about Buddy, who was a wonderful man. Now, I would say Vincent Astor was described to me as the man who, if you saw you were sitting next to him at a dinner party, you would try to move your place card somewhere else. He was just not terrific. He looked a bit like a cigar store Indian. He was about 6'4". He as a young man, just missed being handsome, but by then he had emphysema, he had gained weight. He was not a joy to behold.
And I think she's pretty open about having married him for the money. Didn't Louis Auchincloss say, "I wouldn't respect her if she hadn't, only a twisted person would have married him for love"?
He said that, and he meant it. She never said she married him for the money. She said she turned him down the first time. He and Minnie invite her up for Memorial Day weekend, and at some point he proposes, and she said, "It's too soon." Well, Buddy's barely been dead 6 months or whatever. And then he goes on a trip, and he writes her 2-3 letters a day. And the letters, she later says, persuaded her. When one looks at the letters, they're fine, but they wouldn't make the difference. But she agrees, and she marries him before the year is out. And to the distress, I would say, of Buddy Marshall's family, and to the shock of her friends, Tony, I suspect, may not have been all that happy. He loved his stepfather. Vincent and Tony did not get on, according to most sources, including Brooke herself. She writes about that in Footprints.
Well, Tony's already an adult at this point.
He's married himself, and he has twin sons, I think it's in 1953, so about this time he is having his own family, and they live in Washington.
How long before Vincent died?
Well, Vincent, there's a funny story. His first choice, apparently, was a woman who was very beautiful named Janet Rhinelander Stewart, who was the widow of his best friend. And she had children, and he invited her up for Christmas. And then I think she may have been there that weekend, according to some sources. And he proposed marriage to her, and he proposed it this way. He said, "Janet, my doctors say I don't have more than 3 years to live. And you'll get this and you'll get that." And she looks at him and she says, but Vincent, what if the doctors are wrong?" And she had enough money she could ask that question. And so she remained friendly with Vincent, but she declined his generous offer. Brooke could not afford to be so cavalier about it. And he did go on to live for 6 years, and they were hard years.
Did they sign a prenup or an equivalent?
I think she did, as they were all to do that, and then after a certain number of years, it went up, and then finally, they were together long enough that that went out, and he just left her money in his will.
But there was a courtroom battle over attempts to break Vincent's will.
Well, Vincent had a half-brother. Vincent's father, John Jacob IV, sometimes you see him in various movies being played by one actor or another, went down on the Titanic. And he went down on the Titanic with a young wife who was pregnant. The wife, he helps in a very gentlemanly fashion into a lifeboat, and she is rescued and gives birth several months after his death. And that is John Jacob Astor VI. John Jacob IV has changed his will in such a way that this child will be provided for, but he doesn't know it's going to be a boy. And so he really doesn't get that much money. He gets $5 million when Vincent is getting 70 or so. It's quite different. And Vincent and he never really get on. Well, there's an 18-year difference in age, but also he doesn't grow up to be the kind of young man Vincent would admire. And so Vincent doesn't leave him anything in his will.
Winds up with Brooke in charge of the Vincent Astor Foundation.
Well, he splits his money in half. Half goes to a foundation he'd set up several years before called the Vincent Astor Foundation, which until the time of his death is really a rich man's way of giving money. He puts in about $70 million into that. And then another $70 million goes to support Brooke. Is she gets interest from this money throughout her lifetime. She also gets all his property, all his real estate. And this, at her death, the principle was to go to nonprofit institutions of her choosing.
Well, she, more than most people, really got involved with her philanthropic projects. We're running out of time, and I'm not going to rehash the problems with her son, Tony. People, I'm sure, will remember all of that from the newspapers. But she just turned 105. How's she doing?
Well, she's diminished, but she's in the house she loved. She's in the house where she planned to spend her last days. It has never looked better. And what's happening is, and it's a wonderful thing to see, friends are going up who hadn't seen her in years, and they're visiting her, they're holding her hand, they're talking to her, and they're telling her how... It's funny, I put this in my book, and I seem to have foreseen something. She was a great hand holder. And they go up and they hold her hand and they tell her how much she meant to them and they talk to her. And she is out. She's able to walk some, and she's out in the garden. She's taken out in the garden. And she's with her dogs, her beloved Boise and Girlie.
I'm sure she's not able to have read this book.
No.
But she would be pleased, Frank. You know that.
Well, I would like to think that she would be pleased.
Frances Kiernan will be giving a talk and signing books tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at the Corner Bookstore at Madison Avenue and 93rd Street. The book, The Last Mrs. Astor, A New York Story, is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Well, thank you, Lenny.